The Guardian.
Hi Podfans, Max here. Barry's here.
Yes, of course I am.
Now, if you remember, if you listened all the way to the end of the last pod, you'll have noticed that I said in a few seconds for us, but in a whole podcast time for you, we'd be looking ahead to the life and times of Barney Ronay. And that's where we find ourselves, Barry, looking ahead to the life and times of Barney Ronay. And is there anything you'd like to say about Barney before we hear it?
I'm a big fan of Barney. A lot of people seem to think Barney and I don't like each other, and nothing could be further from the truth. What I particularly like about Barney is the fact that his son thinks I'm the funniest person he's ever heard on radio, and the anguish that caused his father pleases me no end.
I think he just said Barry's funny. I don't think he said the funniest.
No, I think he did. I think Barney has said since that he thinks Family Guy is funnier than me, but I'm happy to play second fiddle to a cartoon sitcom.
Well, listen, if you ever wondered how Barney Ronay ended up doing what he does, this podcast is for you. If you don't care about that, it's going to be hard. It's hard to sell this. Like, if you physically don't want to know anything about Barney Ronay's life, I'm not sure this would be the best use of an hour of your life.
The one thing I would say this pod brings to light is that, contrary to what I certainly thought, and I think a lot of other people presume, is Barney isn't some little Lord Fauntleroy figure who didn't grow up with his own army of nannies and footmen, and that he doesn't have a Batman or butler tending to his every need.
No, because of you, I thought he was the poshest person, and he sort of tried to hide it a bit, but it turns out that isn't true, as you will discover now. We have Barney Ronay in front of us. How are you, Barney?
Yeah, I'm okay, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Do you think...
Could I just say that I would rather take a deep dive into the life and times of Barney Ronay behind his back if he wasn't here?
Well, Barry, I know that's the way it normally works. But I'd like to emphasise that I resisted this process for as long as was... It's like we really have run out of content, haven't we? It's like the bit in Spinal Tap where David St. Hubbins has left the band, and they're playing a festival and they don't have any songs. So they end up playing a 25-minute jazz odyssey while people boo and throw bottles at them and do thumbs down symbols. And they announce it with, I hope you enjoy our new direction. Well, that's what this is.
Is that the bit where they say that support band must have really sucked? They were still booing when we came on.
Yeah.
We've been quite surprised that listeners have enjoyed these looks into the souls of some of our contributors. Do you, Barney, like to, and some of our contributors like talking about themselves, do you like talking about yourself?
No, not at all. I mean, I really like the Philippe one because he actually has an interesting life and other talents and a kind of a hinterland and a kind of a beautiful, soulful way of talking about things. He's wise, funny, reflective. But that's those are rare qualities, as the next 20 minutes will demonstrate.
Mm. So let's start with young Barney. Barney, what is your first ever sporting memory?
Well, it's probably playing sport. I mean, I grew up in Southeast London. Lots of people had that thing of going to a game with their dad, and that's often how people get into football, particularly because it's a weakness passed on through the family. But that didn't happen with me because I grew up in a single parent family. It was just my mum who was an artist and not interested in sport. So I got into sport by playing it. I loved playing football, and I was quite good at it as a kid. And that was the thing that sort of took me out of my house and into the world where these things happen. So I suppose the first game I remember, I started going to watch Charlton Athletic, who were the nearest team, with a friend of mine's parent and one of my friends and their parents. And I remember going to see a Manchester City away game at the Old Valley. And that's my first memory of sport. I remember that because it was the first time I'd ever seen a proper football crowd. Like, Man City brought thousands of people down in the old second division. And I remember Alex Williams was playing in goal for them. And I remember him running towards the fans and seeing this whole end erupt. People didn't wear colours in those days, but there was this real sense of like a mobile army and this big group of people just speaking to itself. And not mocking other people. There was a tendency in football crowds in the 80s to kind of celebrate yourself a bit. And I remember looking at that and thinking, wow, that is fucking cool. And that was my, weirdly, was Man City who got me into football. I just thought, this is brilliant, and I want to go to more of this.
You say you were quite good at football. When people say they were quite good, that can either mean they were hopeless or they were verging on international standard. Were you good, quite good, or bad, quite good?
No, I mean, I was only quite good in the sense that I was good enough to play in teams, which meant that I did stuff that I wouldn't otherwise have done and got into the whole world of sport. I was all right. I mean, I won some trophies with my schoolboy teams. We played in the Metropolitan Five-a-Side, where Ian Wright was the poster boy. He went to school just down the road, and they had this poster for years where they went and said, just get us the most skillful kid in any of these South London schools. We need a kid to do keep-ups. And there was this skinny little kid doing keep-ups on the poster, who then later turned out to be Ian Wright, and who became a bit of a massive hero amongst everyone who played that competition as a result, which was purely a piece of luck. But yeah, I was okay. I trained with child. There weren't really academies in those days, but I played with the sort of Charlton 12 or 13 year olds down near the Ferrier Estate in Thamesmead. And then I had a terrible accident where I ripped all the ligaments in my right knee, and I basically gave up sport for years and didn't play because it was such a painful injury, and I never really recovered from it.
Was that a football injury or something else?
No, Barry, it wasn't a football injury. It was a skiing injury, okay? I went too fast off the side of a mountain.
Barry, why are you laughing so much at the fact that Barney injured his knee skiing?
I honestly didn't know that. I thought, oh, he might have been in a car accident or something, but it is a predictably middle-class injury, isn't it?
It's an injury that helps you with your preset agenda. The narrative that you wish to pursue, which many other people apart from me have also noted in your journalistic work, the need to have your confirmation bias confirmed about me. In fact, it's the one and only time I've ever been skiing, and it was with school. And it was pretty traumatic. But it's good that it confirms your prejudices.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing. And this is why these things, I think, are quite interesting, because I only know of your background from Barry saying you have a footman and a cast of butlers and a sort of a Downton Abbey downstairs who bake all your bread and cook all your food. And so I just sort of presumed that you had some sort of aristocratic upbringing, but it sounds like you didn't really at all.
You do realise I don't really think he has a footman and a butler.
Well, I just kind of started to believe it.
No, actually, it's only funny because it's so far from the truth. I mean, I didn't grow up like that at all. I grew up in South East London. I still live there. We were single parent family, didn't have any cash, but I was one of Thatcher's kind of children. I got one of these state approved scholarships, like a bursary, to go to a posh school when I was 11 from my primary school. So that's how I ended up going on a skiing trip and how I sort of, I ended up sort of talking with a different accent. I used to have quite a sort of very South London accent, and my life was kind of changed by that. Now I can be roundly mocked by Barry for having various things that I don't have but would probably quite like to have. Sadly, don't. All I get is the mockery.
Did you always want to work in sport, or did you not know what you wanted to be or do when you were growing up?
Yeah, I didn't really know that you could work in sport. I mean, there was kind of sport in my family. My grandfather was a professional footballer in Austria, but I didn't really know him due to various sort of issues to do with Europe being in chaos. But there was a bit of sport, but it wasn't. I didn't know anyone who was in sport. I didn't know anyone in journalism. I didn't really know any adults with real jobs. Everyone I knew was kind of a hippie of some kind. And you've got to remember, there wasn't really a sport media in this country until the mid-1990s in the way there is now. Football journalism was basically four or five red-faced men until the Premier League arrived and until Italia 90 And suddenly we had these sports desks with, you know, 50 people on them. We had loads of sport pages, loads of size reporting, loads of color. And it was possible, there was this idea you could have a career in this was something new. So growing up, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I just loved reading. I ended up doing an English degree. And that was about it, really. I didn't really think about careers at all. I didn't know you could actually work in journalism, really.
Owen writes, was Barney good at English at school? I'm an English teacher, and I often use Barney's columns as unseen texts for students to analyse and write about. He doesn't say whether he uses any of Barry's columns, or mine, for that matter, as unseen texts. So you're always naturally good at English?
Yeah, I was just good at writing. You know, that was the one thing I was sort of good at. And I did, I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but I loved the Guardian sports pages as a kid. I used to read David Lacey and Frank Keating, and all the writers were brilliant. And that was like my sort of secret world into sport. And I got to know all these guys and the way they wrote, and they became a kind of thing in my life, but I never sort of imagined you could do it. So yeah, that's sort of what happened.
And you trained as a lawyer or a barrister?
Well, yeah, I finished university. I went to Oxford, where I didn't do very much at all. I actually played a lot of football there. Finally worked out in my final year I was supposed to work and try and get a degree. And then I just sort of left and basically played snooker for a year in the New Cross Inn and kept expecting something to happen. But things never happened, so I needed to earn some money and pay off some debts. So I managed to get a company to sponsor me to train as a lawyer, which was quite an experience. And I ended up practicing for 1 year in the city, well, in Westminster, helping to draft legislation and going to the House of Commons for lunch and things like that. But after a year of it, I just kind of, it's one of those things where you can just, like in Macbeth, you can see, you're given this vision of exactly what you're going to become for the rest of your life. You can see in 5 years you'll be that guy, and in 10 years you'll be that guy. And I just kind of thought, there's not really any point in me doing this. Like, someone else could do it. It's I just couldn't really do it. I mean, it was a decision that has begun to make less and less sense as the people I knew at that time, fellow trainees, have all become QCs and partners and are suddenly earning £1 million a year. But for a while, I was definitely winning by not doing it, just for a while.
But it's quite hard. I mean, there are lots of people who don't know what to do and then go into a job that they don't particularly like and then feel trapped there. It's not an easy decision to stop, to get off any kind of train that is moving and to retrain. How did you do that?
I just felt I didn't have anything to lose. I was sort of, it's one of those things where you just think, I can't go on doing this anymore. It's making me feel pretty bad. So I stopped and thought there must be something better than this. And I gave myself 6 months to, I've got to find something else in 6 months or I'm just going to run out of money. I won't have anywhere to live. I'll be on the streets. And then within about, I was just really lucky. I actually saw a job advert in The Guardian, weirdly enough, for the ITV Digital was starting. Do you remember when ITV Digital started? There's adverts everywhere, 2001, with like Des Lynham saying, this is the new football. The future of football is ITV. ITV, there's going to be a new ITV Premiership era. And they were starting a website, and I just applied for a job on it as a kind of website writer and was lucky enough to get it. And that was it. I was sort of had a foot in the door from there.
What was the first proper thing you did in sports journalism then?
Well, around that time, I started working for When Saturday Comes magazine, who were, still one of my favourite things and my favourite group of people. They're sort of the first real mass, still the only independent football magazine. Take pieces from fans, always, it was basically sort of sprung out of the kind of punk fanzine movement by a guy called Mike Titcher, who still works for The Guardian in Australia. And they gave me a chance to write a bit of stuff. I started going into the office to do bits and bobs on the magazine. And it was a really, really good education at a place that I would still encourage anyone wanting to get on in journalism to send things into. They will read your work, they will look at it, and they will publish it if it's any good. Andy Lyons is the editor, and I still think it's the best thing, because they'll give you a really honest appraisal. And if your work's good enough, they'll publish it. And so When Saturday Comes was a really, really good sort of grounding for me, how to write about stuff, about the idea that football is something for fans, for supporters primarily, rather than broadcasters or players or all the other interests. And that was kind of a formative experience for me.
And did you find it easy straight away, or did you, you know, like Robbie Savage, have to work at your game? Or because a lot of people have asked questions about your writing style. You know, Simon says, does Barney dream in similes? Yogi says, does Barney ever laugh, snort, parp, honk out loud when he's writing in full flow? Did it come very naturally to you?
Yeah, I mean, I just used to read a lot of books. I've always read a lot. And I sort of wanted to be sort of a writer, really, rather than a football journalist. But sort of ended up doing football because I had these two interests. And it's just one style. There's loads of people out there who I think are really good football writers, and who I read just because you get a really good mix of both being very informed and being able to write well. So there are people like that who are...
Like who, Barney?
I suppose I'd always read Sam Wallace, who I think is really good, who writes in a really entertaining way, but actually has a hell of a large knowledge about football as well. Yeah, there's loads of people. I mean, obviously you, Barry, obviously... Jonathan Liu, who is now our colleague, is brilliant. Rory Smith's really good. But not just people from broadsheets newspapers. There's lots of people who have totally different skills to me, who I think are brilliant, who understand how hard news works and will actually give you information. So I think we're lucky to have lots of brilliant writers. And if you want one thing, you can come and read my kind of stuff. Or if you want other... stuff with slightly more news depth or a little bit more inside information, you can go there. There's a lot to read. People always endlessly moan about the media in this country, but I think if you like football, pretty good, you know.
What's the work you're most proud of? Nigel Adderley, the commentator, sent a question saying, you know, is the Millwall stuff you did the stuff you're most proud of? What would you say?
Yeah, in one way. I mean, that was really different. That was something where I went back to being a lawyer in a way, and I was just trawling through endless official documents, financial documents, council planning documents, and use this entirely different set of skills to the usual kind of writing a flowery piece of work. And it was absolutely fascinating, I have to say. There were so many connections in that thing. There was so much stuff that didn't get published. I met so many interesting people. There's a fascinating kind of film in it or a book in it at some point. That was really interesting and a very sort of strange period in many ways. We ended up getting very involved in the political side of it, which was most unexpected. I was pretty proud of that. But I'm also proud of some of the things that I wrote, which I think are good. And sometimes I look back and think, my God, how on earth did I get away with writing that crap? There's actually a bit that Jonathan Wilson always takes the mickey out of me, where I compare Jonathan Trott to a badger in a waistcoat. For some reason, it just seemed like a good way of feeling
An anthropomorphic badger in a waistcoat with a talent for growing tomatoes was the line.
Yeah. I looked back at the article the other day and I went through it. I went through the England batting order in it. This was years ago. And in it, I described how each of the players made you feel, their stage in your life. So you go from the kind of excitement of being an opener and being everything so clear and pristine to being a tail ender where you're kind of running out of energy and dying. And you know, Stuart Broad's attempts to bat are like your elderly relative's attempts to master new technology, completely baffled. And the last line is, James Anderson's reverse sweep is the last erection you'll ever have.
Oh, no.
And I read that and just held my head in my hands and thought, how was that published? I mean, it's just a dreadful thing that you might possibly think but shouldn't actually end up in the paper. So there are moments like that, right? I kind of feel bad and think maybe I went too far.
Do you have sort of a one method for writing a column, or does sometimes, you know, you just sit there and you just write it in one go in an hour and it's easy, and other times you're there for hours and hours and hours?
Yeah. Please bear in mind that as soon as we finish recording this podcast, I have to fill the very, well, metaphorically very big stilettos of razor sharp stilettos, marine hide. So I'm going to listen to this answer with a lot of interest.
Well, you'll probably be disappointed then, because, I mean, I have no idea, but I think there are two, I think most people say there's two ways it happens, where if there's something you really believe in quite strongly, and where you there's something you just really want to say that you think needs to be said about an issue, it tends to just come straight out of the hand. You just write it instantly. Whereas when there are aspects of nuance, or, you know, quite often you just have to write a column, it can take forever, and you end up writing around it and editing down some huge amount of floppy sort of crap. But when those moments where there's something you really, you know, where the calendar necessity to actually write something flukishly intersects with the idea there's actually something worth writing about, then it tends to come out really quickly and to actually be good as well. But on the other hand, the ability to just do it and keep doing it, even when you don't have that feeling, is probably what distinguishes being able to do this professionally from being a very good writer who might do it in your spare time.
Yeah, I think, Barry, you've mentioned that, haven't you, that quite a lot of quite famous people have had that back page on The Guardian and have gone, I've got a Guardian column and this is great. And after 4 weeks have gone, I've got to write another one.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of what happened with Russell Brand, and I wouldn't imagine, I don't think Darrow Breen would mind saying that he was very chuffed to get a Guardian column. But then once the novelty had worn off and he was sort of writing it in the back of his tour car on a Friday afternoon, desperately trying to think of something to write 800 words on. The thing is, if you're someone like Russell Brand or Darrow Breen and you're earning, I don't know, tens of thousands of pounds a night on tour, the amount of money you get paid for a Guardian column by comparison is peanuts. And it probably doesn't take them long to realise it's not worth the hassle and aggravation involved. I should add, I did enjoy the columns written by both comedians I've mentioned.
It's all right, Barry, you don't need to suck up to them. Russell Brand was my immediate predecessor on the Guardian back page. And his columns were really good at the start. I thought they were really funny. He used to just be a real sort of filthy kind of bloke who just, you know, told you about his interesting low life. But he's gone through this period of becoming inspirational, hasn't he? And I think that coincided with his Guardian columns kind of dropping off a cliff. They very quickly just became this kind of totally empty space. I remember the subs kind of holding their head in their hands when they came in saying, What do we do with this? It was extraordinary. Like, I think he started dictating them in the back of a cab onto something else, and it was a strange moment where we'd get them with 20 minutes to go, and some poor, extremely experienced, skillful sub would try to make Russell's kind of meanderings into an actual newspaper column, and in the end, yeah, it just became, there was like nothing there. It just became unsustainable. But he was very good at the start, I have to say.
Can I ask about writing books, Barney? Because they seem like a lot of effort, and you've written, is it four? How many have you written?
Yeah, I've written a few books. I mean, I find books really difficult as well. Some people have a natural kind of rhythm for that. But the last one I wrote was about the World Cup in 2018, just sort of traveling around Russia. And that was fun because it was kind of a travelogue. It was kind of reportage. But they are very difficult. And there's something that, a good book will be something you have to fight to get published generally. It's something you really believe in. Every single book I've written so far has been a book that's basically been brought to me by a publisher with an idea. And it's kind of a job. It's like a journalistic job. So I'm not particularly proud of any of them, to be honest. I've never had the gumption to have a really good idea and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take rejection. I'm going to see it. And those are always the best books. Those are always the best bits of anything anyone ever creates. When you just say, I'm not going to take rejection. I'm going to stick at this. This is my idea. And those end up being great books or great sitcoms or whatever. And I can't claim to have ever done anything like that. I'd say most of my books are hack work.
Have you ever been tempted to perhaps take a really intensive look at the tactics of Hungarian football in the 30s and put that into a book?
Well, that is an example, in fact. I mean, that's something Wilson really interested in. And obviously, much of it is, although he'd never say this, effectively a homage to me and to my background and my family, which is really nice. and he doesn't need to say that, it's understood. But that kind of thing, you know, I admire him for doing that. But I've never quite had the balls to do that.
Has your relationship with sport changed working in it? I mean, does the magic go? I was thinking specifically about those 3 days last season when I don't know if you went to all these games, but, you know, Vincent Kompany scored that 25-yarder to basically give City the title. Then Liverpool beat Barcelona 4-0. Then Spurs won in Ajax. And from an armchair fan sitting on the sofa, it was like the most amazing 3 days of football. But for those journalists who are at each of those games, the travel, having to write, travel again, write, being away from home, I wonder if that takes the magic away, even though you're in this amazingly privileged position to have seen three amazing moments.
Yeah, I mean, that was incredible. That was different, because that was, that was just a relentless adrenaline high. It was brilliant. Probably the most intense 3 days, more intense than a tournament. And every single game went to the last second, the last twist, and that was just brilliantly enjoyable. It was exhausting, and for about a week after that, I felt terrible. But it's more the weekly grind of it that can be kind of get you down. But then. I love being at the events. Being at the events is just something you never lose. And I'll probably will be one of those really old guys still going and doing this, because there's nothing quite like it. That's the bit you get addicted to. And I like being around the people. There's a very nice kind of spirit among sports journalists, which you don't often see, where people are good colleagues from other newspapers, from other outlets. People look after each other a bit. People are friendly. There's a camaraderie with people you don't really know that well, but you might see year on year on year. And it's a fantastic job. And, you know, anyone who's thinking of getting into it, it is difficult. It's very hard to see a way in, but it's not impossible. And it is rewarding and fun. And when you're in it in that moment, sort of unlike anything else.
If you could pick a game or a tournament above any other, is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, some of them just sort of stand out that you really enjoy being at. For some reason, I always think back to Euro 2008 and Croatia 2, Germany 3 in Klagenfurt, which probably isn't the game most people think of. But I loved that tournament. It was the first big tournament I've been to. Croatia won that game and were fantastic. The pitch, you were really close to the action. You could see Luka Modric, all of that incredible Croatian front three, really close up. You could see them making Germany run. You could see this feeling of one team asserting itself over the other one. That was fantastic. And it was slightly wild in Klagenfurt after that. There was this weird feeling on the streets. It's a strange place. And it was just a kind of amazing sort of night. And most recently, similar sort of thing, I loved going to Spain versus Russia at the World Cup in 2018 for different reasons. That was the game that just went on forever, where Spain just had the ball constantly, but you knew somehow they were going to lose. And I was sat there with Sid in the stands, and we were both, for some reason, we were not that well. I think we were really hungover. We were drinking Diet Coke and just sort of talking to each other and saying, oh my God, this is just going to go on forever, forever. Just hypnotized by Spain passing the ball around. But somehow we got through it and had to file on the whistle and in extra time and on the final whistle. And somehow we both produced out of it articles that we're really proud of, that were basically just an extension of the conversation we'd had for about 2 hours. And I just really enjoyed that. It was really good fun.
Can I ask, Barney, say a Champions League night, so you're on a very tight deadline, you're the sidebar colour king, so you have to file maybe 10, 15 minutes before the end of the game. You're obviously given an idea of what to write about, which is clearly subject to change if anything extraordinary happens in the game or someone has a particularly good or bad game. Do you go in with stuff prepared? Are you good at writing under pressure? Or are you like me? Do you go into a total panic and sort of forget basic English as you watch the clock tick down and the cursor blink in the corner of the screen?
It is quite a weird thing to do. I mean, in case people, you know, just to explain it, it's probably quite boring, but basically you're just told to file 900 words by 9:30 in a game that finishes at 9:40. That's the only real guidance. And it can't be a match report. It's got to be on a theme. It's got to be about something. So often you're filing this piece before the game is finished, having written it while half watching it. And by that stage, panic kind of sets in. The only thought is this has to be some coherent sentences that can be in the newspaper and look okay. And that's basically the skill. You just have to be able to file that and to send something that looks like a football report. We're still on these kind of slightly absurd deadlines. But if you're late and they can't send the page or it gets delayed, it costs thousands of pounds. So that kind of fear kicks in and you end up just forcing yourself to do it on this sort of adrenal rush of Haribo and coffee and just kind of throwing in anything you can. And that the weird thing is that edition of the paper basically really only goes to the outer parts of the, it'll go online and then go to like Cornwall. And you know, Paul Hayward always sort of once said to me, they must think football journalists are ridiculous in Cornwall. They must look at it and think like, this bloke's an idiot. Like, he doesn't even know the score. Like, but if you're in Cornwall, don't bother reading the football reports, because what you've got there is the inner workings of someone's crazed, panic-stricken mind, just trying to keep their job by not delaying the page going. So, but then after you've sent the kind of madness to the people in Cornwall, and which often goes up on the web as well, you get, I don't know, half an hour to rewrite. And that's really the skill, you know, that people often say, well, you've missed this, or you didn't fully analyze that thing to do with VAR, or, you know, maybe you've got the wrong guy doing the assist. But the fact is, you're just in a panic. Often there's no replay. You just have to file something 10 minutes before the game finishes. And that's the skill, you know, enjoy it. It's a feat of people getting things on a page, basically.
Can I ask, Barry, if you had to choose between only being able to write about football for the rest of your career or only being able to write about cricket, which would you pick?
Well, I mean, it'd probably be cricket, but although I think probably football's the more sensible choice. Writing about cricket is different. It's kind of, you get a long time to do it. They give you lots of really nice food. It's incredibly restful in the press boxes. And, you know, I love the game. It's got so much depth to it. It's a very different thing. It might not have the kind of big emotional notes of football all the time, or be quite a sort of thrilling in the moment. It's more of a slow burn thing. It's more of a sort of literary experience, cricket. But I mean, cricket journalists, they travel constantly. I wouldn't like to. I think I could handle that. There's a lot of. It's a very tight knit bunch because they're away together all the time. And I sort of dip into that world, but. It's kind of a fascinating world.
It is. And in my limited experience of covering both football and cricket broadcasting, the cricket commentary box is a totally amazing thing where you're just sort of sitting there chatting away to some absolute Mike Hussey, some legend of the game, and then another legend of the game like Farouk Engineer will just sort of wander in and go, is it my turn? And someone says, half an hour, Farouk. And he goes, very good. And then you go back. You go into another room and Sunil Gavaskar is having a nap. And the whole thing is, and the food, you're right, Barney, is ridiculous. And compared to the intensity of football, it's a totally different thing. But I guess a cricket commentary, that whole area is exactly, I think, what I hoped it would be.
It's like a sitcom. You know, they say the best sitcom is where the characters can't escape. Like, there's nowhere to go. You can't stop being a rag and bone man. You can't. No one can leave. You're stuck. You're in prison. It's porridge. Well, cricket's like that. No one can escape from it. The people in cricket are totally stuck in cricket. Their whole life. I always used to talk to Mike Selvey when he was in the press box, and every reference he had, everyone he knows is an. I'd sort of mention something. Oh, do you remember Alan Lamb doing this 30 years ago? And he'd be like, oh, yeah, I saw Lamy last night at a barbecue. Like, everyone he knows is a famous cricketer from the 1980s. His whole life, there is nothing else. It's this total lifestyle that just consumes them. I don't think football's quite that. I think people escape from it at times, often out of necessity. But, it's a strange world.
We had a few questions from listeners. Richard said, who is or was Barney's favourite footballer to watch? Not necessarily the best, just favourite.
Well, it's a fairly sort of cliched answer. I suppose growing up or when I was younger, I loved watching Gascoigne. He was the first footballer who just absolutely thought, wow, this guy is just amazing. He made you laugh, the thing he did on the pitch. And you could see that there was something about him that just didn't fit into the standard human template, just the way he spoke, the way he did stuff. I was watching the Gazza documentary the other day. There's a relatively new one, and there was a detail I'd missed. You know, when he fouls, I can't remember which player it is, to get his second booking in the 1990 semi-final. And he goes through him. He says he didn't touch him at all. And there's the thing about him crying and blah, blah, blah. Well, he pointed out that actually he was really annoyed because the player was screaming on the floor. And Gazza said, I was really annoyed. He was screaming. I hadn't touched him. He just wanted to get me booked. So I went up to him and put my hand in his mouth and grabbed his tongue to stop him screaming so the ref wouldn't come over. And they replayed it. And you can see Gazza putting his hand in this guy's mouth, trying to grab his tongue to stop him from screaming. And he's sort of laughing about it. And you just think, like, who does that? It's just such a funny thing to do. But I loved watching him, you know, head up, just sort of running around thing. This is a game I can just take control of. I suppose probably I was thinking about this, probably now my favorite player is probably Riyad Mahrez, just because similarly he always makes me laugh whenever I see him. He's like a mime artist or something. The things he does are hilarious and entirely his. He's made up this series of physical movements which fool these professional athletes again and again, and I find him completely mesmeric to watch and just really fun.
A couple of threads of questions. We had a lot of questions on this subject. Craig, what is currently the longest running Witch's Curse? Mitchell, Tottenham Hotspur haven't played in their new stadium for months now. Another sign of the Witch's Curse. And Matt, at what point in his life did the magic die and Barney stop believing in the power of the Witch's Curse? Rigoberto saying it remains the Barney v. Barry Witch's Curse discourse, a high watermark for Football Weekly Mac 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that probably was quite an interesting thing in a way, and that why was I going on about witches? I think it's that idea that...
I think you were taking the piss out of me, but actually I would go so far as to say you were bullying me.
Maybe I think I was imputing something to you that you didn't actually believe, because I was annoyed with that thing, but then I refused to accept that you didn't actually believe it anyway on a point of principle. But it's this idea, I suppose, it's the lack of analysis, the kind of, oh, you know, there's what's wrong with, you know, Spurs? They're bottlers and that kind of thing. When in fact, at that stage, I think they'd probably simply not bought any players. You know, that team was in the process of dying and not renewing itself. And the issue was, you know, a lack of management of the team. And so the constant talk about what's wrong with this team, it just really annoyed me as a kind of non-forensic way of looking at things. And then Barry started ranting on about a witch's curse, which he seemed obsessed with, and still to this day maintains is the issue here. And I snapped finally after, you know, years of this.
I was, just while Barry was talking there, I was racking my brains because I couldn't remember what the witch's curse was. It wasn't specifically to do with Tottenham's inability to win semi-finals or something.
Yeah, oh, they tend to lose to the team which has eerily spent £200,000 more on players, and who tends to be the team who's also going for this final stage of a tournament or a league. You know, I just felt that we could probably analyse it in slightly in a colder light than simply dwelling on your absolute ongoing obsession with witches' curses.
How did your subsequent hearing with human resources go? I note you're still employed by The Guardian. Did you at least get an official written warning about your bullying behaviour?
Well, if I mention witches' curses again on a Football Weekly show, I'm apparently out of the building. But this will all be edited out, won't it?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
There is one other. There is quite a long-running contest as to who is the most misanthropic panellist out of Barry Glendening, Barney Ronay, and Jonathan Wilson. But quite a lot of questions, Barney, came in this way. The DOS box, what drove the change to his Guardian profile pic from young T-shirt-wearing Barney to tired, jaded Barney? SHL, how can someone so miserable on the pod yet be so funny in their columns? And Simon, why did Barney get 10 times more miserable once The Guardian updated his headshot?
I mean, the story of that headshot update incident is that I refused... I never go in the office. Periodically I'd be pestered to update the pic. That one was from something like 2002, the initial one. And it just kept going forever for years. And I kind of quite enjoyed the fact it was still there. And then finally they kind of collared me on some morning about whatever it was 3 years ago. And there I am staring out resentfully into the camera, the most miserable looking kind of collared, I really want to go person being told to do this by a photographer. But I think I was probably at something of a physical low at that moment. It doesn't represent, it's not a snapshot of a happy time. I like to think I've probably got slightly younger and more cheerful since that picture was taken. I might update it again with a kind of cheeky grin. and try and restage the photo.
The most angry I've ever seen Jonathan Wilson, his temper was basically inflamed at having to get a new Guardian mugshot taken. It's quite a stressful ordeal, and it shouldn't be, but it really is.
I remember this. Yeah, there was some sort of altercation, wasn't there?
Mine is still from 2008, and I'm happy to occasionally see myself with completely different colour hair. I'm sticking with it for the whenever I do a what I did on my summer holidays article, as Barry calls them. Steve says, often wondered who the hardest Football Weekly contributor is, not in a knobhead way or out, more if it all kicked off at a post-live show pints in Reykjavik, say. Who would you want to step behind you? Always thought Ronay or Doyle.
I mean, you're hardly choosing from a particularly elevated kind of pantheon of noted hard men. who's the hardest Guardian Football Weekly contributor? If it's between me and Doyle, it's definitely Doyle.
Mm.
I'd walk away from that contest.
You could out-simile the hardest of hard men, Barney, and hope that they would run
away. I don't know, yeah. It's a pretty tough school, those underground bare-knuckle simile contests around the den, in the arches around the den. I wouldn't start shouting your mouth off, Max. You know, you'll get a challenge.
In that sort of athletic beginning, I think they came in for you, Barney. Big money offer, huge glitzy contract, and you turn them down for the humble old school newspaper that it is, The Guardian. Why did you do that?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough question, Max. Well, it's true. I did go and meet them. I met the people who founded it, and I like them. And I know the editor and various people involved. And there's lots of people who write for them who I like. But I guess in the end, I wanted to write for a newspaper. And I found their model pretty hostile towards newspaper. I like, you know, I want to be in the same thing as something which is writing about things happening in the world, not just football. I want to be in the same paper as Marina Hyde and Gary Young and whoever else is good out there. You know, I like those people. I like reading them. And I also had a slight problem with the model. I was slightly troubled by the model, I guess. Subscription is undoubtedly the future. And some people do this really well, but I just slightly struggle with the idea of how you, I guess, write about clubs when that club's fan base is your audience and subscriptions are everything. And those people might not always want to hear everything you've got to write about their club. You might write things that they disagree with or dislike, or which make you public enemy number one. Well, you're simply not going to survive. So you kind of have to preach to a certain kind of line if you want to be successful in that job. And I just couldn't quite see how that would fit the way I like to write about things. My Man City piece, for example, might not be one that the subscribers really, really go for, but I'd still like to write it. So it probably wasn't for me.
Finally, Lorenzo says, what is the worst thing, brackets, things, about working with Max and Barry?
Well, there are no bad things. The one thing about Football Weekly and The Guardian is actually... The Guardian's like a Stalinist bureaucracy. It can be incredibly frustrating. Just to get on this call, we had to do all these tech things, and there are loads of people involved, and loads of decisions, no doubt, had to be made. It can drive you mad. But the actual people are really nice. And I've never known anyone in our office or on this show who's had a big ego or been, you know, look at me or this or that. And it's actually a good place. So, no, I have no complaints.
Thanks, Barry. Thank you, Barney, for doing that podcast a year and a half ago. That's all I have to say at the end of this one. We've got one more intro to do, and we'll do that in a second on the next pod. We'll see you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.